In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Been looking forward to my next interview, by the way, immensely. The book is called Try Not to Hold It Against Me, A Producer's Life. It's the new memoir from legendary stage and screen producer Julian Schlossberg. It's now available. It's been entered its second printing, published by Beaufort Books, all about life on the edge, around about rubbing shoulders with the rich and famous. But many of our listeners probably won't know what on earth a producer actually does. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere with an extensive library in the background, Julian Schlossberg. Julian, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Well, good afternoon to you, and thank you so much for inviting me to hit Europe again. This has been a while.
we were just talking off air, and you have an affinity with Spain.
I certainly do. It's a country I love so much. I spent a lot of time in Madrid and Barcelona, Marbella, but I lived on Mallorca for a while, so I had a lovely time in Palma de Mallorca. But I'm going to answer your question when we were much younger.
Indeed. Indeed. Yeah. When we had sort of 70s hair, if any hair at all.
Exactly. Exactly. What happened was the producers become a name that really seems to be 18 producers on television and movies. And the real producer, not someone who's put up the money or a star's agent or a star's lawyer, the person who really produces, finds the project, tries to find a good director that matches that project, gets involved in raising the money, helps in the casting, gets involved and in charge of the advertising, the publicity, the marketing. It's an endless job, because the project can keep coming back to you. I've made movies that 2 years later, someone writes and says, "We just sold it in Okinawa. Do you have any?" What? I said, "Okinawa?" And anyhow, it's a job that doesn't stop. But despite the fact that it has an enormous amount of pressure at times, it's very, very satisfying for someone like myself. I enjoy it very much. It gives me an opportunity to work with creative people and hopefully even have some input in the project.
Because this is the thing. I mean, when we were all young with the 70s hair or even earlier hair, I mean, if you think about theater, or you want to, you know, you want to get involved in the film business, you know, people want to be actors, don't they? Or they want to be directors, or perish the thought, you know, cinematographers. So people overlook producers. And now in a world where every star seems to be executive producer, or this is my own project, it has, like the music business, there are so many people getting involved, where I imagine at when you started off, it was very much a more intimate, more over lunch sort of, and more shoe leather sort of dealings.
Well, that's true. And it's also interesting, you know, despite the fact that I'm going to sound a bit like an apologist about actors and stars, but one has to remember that the time someone makes it in this business, they have been treated most likely badly. They've gone to auditions over and over and not got the job. They've been treated, as I say, they're damaged goods. And so sometimes that anger that has developed over those years can come out when they become someone. So I'm much more tolerant than most people about actors and their foibles, because A, they're naked out there. They're the ones that are, and often they're the ones that are selling your project. So I think I probably sound like an apologist, but I understand, I guess. So as we say in traffic court, guilty, with an explanation.
And I suppose that the other thing is the fact that if they're in a movie that doesn't do so well or isn't critically well received, you're going to get somebody to come up to you in a restaurant and go, hey, buddy, your last movie absolutely wasn't very good, but not those words, Julian.
That's exactly right. And it's so interesting, too, because it's generally the star that gets the credit one way or the other. Oh, my God, Kevin Costner's new movie just bombed. Hugh Jackman, what happened to him? Oh, Streisand's through. I mean, these kind of things you hear all the time. No one says the director messed up, the producer messed up. How about the writer? I mean, if we go by Shakespeare, the play's the thing. He's fine, too. They don't talk about him. I'm a little more sympathetic to actors than most people in my business.
When you think about it, producing, I mean, with the actor, and this is going to sound awful, the director, they do the lines, make sure the angles are in, the camera angles, the lights there, you know, the driver's turned up, that sort of thing. You are doing what I call sort of crisis management and chaos theory at all times. There is no end to things that can muck. I mean, in the nicest possible way, how do you look so young and how do you sleep at night? Because during the production of a movie and getting the funding, for goodness sake, it must be a gargantuan affair.
Well, I love what you said, crisis management. That is a great one. I'm going to steal that if you don't mind.
Management and chaos theory at all times, Julian.
It is true. And what happens often now, and this is coming from an 80-some-odd-year-old man, so we have to be careful that generation problem, but a lot of these younger directors are very well steeped in lighting and camera angles, et cetera. They're not too good talking to an actor or helping in the writing. And frankly, to me, that's much more important. I mean, where the camera is placed can be important, of course. I'm not negating that. But it's nothing compared to helping the performance or getting involved with the script where a scene doesn't work. So I'm always cognizant of the fact that I am much better off trying to get a seasoned pro than unless someone I've met I'm so impressed with, even though they are young. After all, I started young, so I don't want to hold prejudice against young people. What? But I have found that often they lack the knowledge to how you talk to an actor. You can't walk over to an actor often and just say, you know, I don't like the way you're doing that. Well, that yes. And what should I do? What do you think I should do? You know, I worked with Mike Nichols, and one of Mike Nichols' great directions were often same thing, just say it a little faster.
Well, when you started out, it would have been sort of very easy to go, okay, we're going to make B movies, we're going to make exploitation movies, I'm going to get the dollar in quickly, turn it around, have a great time. That was never your raison d'etre, was it, Julian? You wanted to make a statement.
No, not how I kind of conducted my life. I'm happy to say, I mentioned in the book that Frank D. Gilroy, who won the Pulitzer for the play and the movie, the subject was Roses, once said that on your tombstone, Julian, it will say quality was his undoing. So I guess I have to remember that I have to be careful. Yeah, I'm attracted to intelligent work. I'm attracted to where stars are not necessarily the most important thing. They are as far as getting the money, and often they're the best person for a particular role. But just to get a name has never been my goal. Mm. And but I've had a lot of fun working with wonderful actors from England. I've done work with Vanessa Redgrave and Eileen Atkins and Tom Courtney and Alan Bates and so many of the great English actors, and it's been a pleasure working with them. They rarely come up with things like, I don't like my costume. You know, you don't generally hear that, you know, or only shoot me on the right side, only my right side, as if what happened on the left, was there a terrible accident somewhere? I'm not sure, but okay. So I've enjoyed working with the Brits a lot.
Is it true because you can tell if they've done theatre because they've got they bring that with them. And rather than cut a scene down to several bits, I remember one actor saying, I had this long monologue, and the director said, who was from across the pond, said, we could do this in three different things. And he said, no, I'll just learn it. And they were like, good grief, because perhaps if you've done rep for a while, then you have to do one Shakespeare and then something else. And so you just learn it's acting, dear boy.
Yes, I will say this, though. England, London specifically, has a huge advantage over America in this one regard. In America, if you want to do movies, you've got to be basically in Los Angeles. If you want to do theater, you basically have to be in New York. London gives you both. And that's a big, big leg up, a big leg up. I wish we had that here in this country, but we don't, obviously. You know, I was thinking the other day, I'm writing a second book because I guess the first book went reasonably well. I'm happy
just
about
slightly,
it.
Just slightly went reasonably. It went off the charts.
So I just came across a wonderful note that I took. I was friendly with a wonderful actor named Eli Wallach, and he was making The Misfits, and he was working with John Huston. Of course, in the movie was Marilyn Monroe and Montgomery Clift and Clark Gable, one of the great, great casts of all time. Not the movie, but the cast was great. Anyhow, he was working with Huston, and he had to play a drunk scene. And he came in slurring his words and whirling and weaving, and Huston yelled, cut, cut. And he said, Eli, let me talk to you. And Eli came over, he says, you know, the most drunk I ever was in my life? And Eli said, well, no, John, when was that? He said, yesterday. Yesterday. And he understood that often people who are drunk are trying to appear sober. And Eli did the scene perfectly after that direction. That's a small example of what a good director can do.
And you've worked with other great directors. I mean, the Othello print, the Orson Welles Othello, that must have been, because that is, it is like perhaps like holding the Mona Lisa, or I mean, how do you approach something with that? And also, you talk about working with legends. I mean, you worked with Kazan, for goodness sake, as a young man. Again, these guys must come with certain gravitas that you must think, okay, I really am here, but I'm pinching myself quite ferociously.
It's true. I'm still pinching myself, and they're both gone. They're not even with me anymore, but they are. That's the idea. Yes, if you're fortunate enough to be able to work with some of the finest people in your business, your game gets better. It just has to, or they're going to dump you. They're not going to be with you. The interesting thing about the Orson Welles project was that here was a man who had made a movie, Othello. Now, granted, it was Wellesian Othello, not Shakespearean Othello. It was only 90-some-odd minutes. Right off the bat, you know, that's not all of Shakespeare. But he had made it, and it opened. He won the Cannes Film Festival in 1952. He couldn't find an American distributor. Nobody would distribute it. Years went by, and finally United Artists opened the movie in Manhattan. It got bad reviews, and it was it. It languished for 40 years. And I met, fortunately, his youngest daughter, a beautiful woman named Beatrice Wells, and she said, do you know anything about this movie? I said, no. I know Macbeth. I know he made Macbeth. I know he made Falstaff as Chimes at Midnight. But I don't know anything. She says, well, will you look at it? I looked at it, and it was incredible, but it was out of sync. It was totally out of sync. I was so surprised. But when I started learning that it had, what I meant by out of sync, I should say quickly, was if I said hello, about 2 seconds later, someone's mouth would move. You know, it was just not right. It had to be married and done. The music was not well recorded because he did it after World War II in Italy. Now, after World War II in Italy was not what you'd call prime time.
Not a lot standing, was there, basically?
Absolutely correct. And also in Italy, as you may know, they don't worry about sound. They post-sync everything. So you can say whatever you want. They're going to still put it in later. anyhow, we ended up taking the movie and re-recording. The two men in Chicago re-recorded note for note the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, the entire score. And in New York, I was able to get the best mixer there is in New York. Now, I should quickly explain that when you mix a movie comes in three tracks. One is the soundtrack, like we're talking now. Second is, thank goodness we don't have background noise, but often it's traffic or planes or whatever, something. And then third is the music. And you take those three tracks and you marry them together into one track. And that's what a mix is called. That's what a mix is. So what we had to do was to open up the tracks, re-record again, and then get the film back into sync where the mouth and the words came together correctly. It was arduous. And I wanted Lee Dichter. His name was Lee Dichter. He mixed all the movies for Woody Allen, Mike Nichols, Nora Ephron, the best New York directors. And he said, I'm booked, Julian. I can't do it. I'm totally booked. I said, no, I don't want you to do it. I just need your advice. Will you look at the first reel? He said, sure. Well, I put the first reel on, and it is magnificent. It is so brilliantly shot, and it's music and incredible photography. And and he turns to me in the middle, and he says, why, you son of a bitch. He was so mad at me because I knew he was an artist, and I knew any person who had any art in them would want to be involved in this movie. And he turned to me and he said, okay, we're going to have to work at night and we're going to have to work on weekends because I'm booked, but I have to do this movie. And he did it. So I think, to answer your question, when we were much younger, I think that was an arduous but beautiful project and one that I'm most proud of.
I was going to say, when the lights went down and it appeared on the screen with, and mixing and sound makes such a difference to a movie. If it's great, it will bring the emotions in, but you won't notice it. It doesn't go da da da, dramatic bit or romantic bit, do do do. But if it gets under the back of your neck just there, and to see something like, Orson Welles must have been, I mean, we'll talk high-flying art here, Julie, if we may, but it really is.
Well, it's true what you say. I mean, it's absolutely the case. And how many times you'll go with your wife, girlfriend, boyfriend, whoever you're going with, and say, what did they say? What did they say? Because that means the mix is no good. Now, you know why a mix sometimes is no good? The director and the editor who've been working on it have heard it so often that they hear it. They hear it fine. So what I've always done on my movies is at the end, before I marry everything, I bring in a couple of friends and say, tell me if there's anything you don't hear that you could not hear, because you want the audience to hear every word.
It's the Oscars this weekend, you may have noticed, and you've done a few in your time, shall we say. As a producer, how important are they to you? Because is it a case of the thing that if you go shooting for an Oscar, you won't get it? I suppose it would get more bums on seats, as we say in the UK. But presumably when you come to the end of it, must be a very strange feeling when you're coming to the end of a film, because you've already got two or three other projects that you're looking forward to. And so to go back and do you feel like sometimes you're revisiting the films?
Well, I think it's a good question. And I'll tell you, there are times in my life that I've watched a movie I've done on television and say, I knew I should have fought more for that. And I'm still upset about something that happened years ago. It's such a collaborative medium in all of what we do in show business is, whether it's a television show or a series, whether it's a movie, whether it's theater, it's collaborative. And one of the exciting parts about writing Try Not to Hold It Against Me was it was me. I didn't have to ask for okay, permission, what do you think? I just did it. Of course, an editor came in at the end and wrestled me to the ground at times. But by and large, I got what I wanted. That was an interesting experience not to be collaborating.
Mm. The title as well, Don't Hold It, Try Not to Hold It Against Me. But you've been described, Mike Nichols said you basically that you were the nicest man, in the business. So have you made some terrible enemies? Is F. Mary Abraham out to get you? Is he standing in the background with a poignard? I mean, why try not to hold it against me?
Well, the first of all, that Murray said that, that I'm the nicest man in the business, could have thrown me out of the Producers League.
Fair enough.
I could have been bumped just on that. But the question asked was, why do I call it Try Not to Hold It Against Me? Well, I write about very controversial figures who were in my life. I start with Elia Kazan, one of the great directors of theater and film. But he named names during the McCarthy period. A lot of people resent that still to this day. I understand why they feel that way. But, you know, the interesting thing is Jerome Robbins, Lee J. Cobb, Clifford Odets, Bud Schulberg, a lot of people name names. But Kazan was more vocal about how much he hated the communists. So the number one is Kazan. Number two, there was a rock and roll promoter in Buffalo, New York, who came to me to learn the movie business. And I taught him the film business. He was very, very bright. He had a great sense of humor and had taste. But he turned out to be Harvey Weinstein. So, you know, when you have people like Weinstein and Kazan, and I consulted for a man named Alan Klein. Alan Klein had kind of worked with Sam Cooke and then became the manager of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. A lot of people were not happy with him as a human being. I was. He was terrific to me. I once said to him, I don't understand. I said, you know, we've done a lot of business together. We've been together a long time. You've never once tried to even screw me. And he said, he didn't do what most people in that position do, which is, what do you mean? How can you say that? I was just honored by the Brene Brith. Wherever he said, hey, everybody's got to have a friend. I said, can I tell that story? He says, I don't care who you tell. So so between Alan and Elia Kazan and Harvey Weinstein, there are enough people there that people could say, hey, how could you work with so-and-so? Well, I did. And I'm not apologizing for it because I did not see those sides that they were noted for, let's say. Mm. I was lucky. I never, ever would say it could never happen to me. If somebody has a reputation and they're not so terrific and they're great with you, it doesn't mean you're going to get away with it. It just means you've so far done okay. And I was lucky. None of those people ever turned on me.
And you also, you know, have several well-known as your friend, Liza Minnelli, who spent a lot of time in Marbella, Barbara Streisand as well, Pacino. But F. Murray, I do want to talk about F. Murray Abraham, because he's an exceptional human being, an exceptional talent. And the thing is with him is that people will go, huh? And you go, Salieri, Amadeus. Oh, okay, fine. But there is so much more to him, isn't there?
Well, there is. And a man who can play beautifully a gay man in The Ritz, the movie The Ritz that Richard Lester directed, and then be able to play Salieri in Amadeus. I mean, what an incredible range that man has. He can do comedy. He can do farce. He can do Shakespeare. He's an extraordinary actor and a very interesting man. He grew up in El Paso, Texas, which is a border town, which means it's close to Mexico. And he ran with Mexicans and in gangs. He was actually a juvenile delinquent. And he had a Tex-Mex accent. But he got involved in theater, and he realized his voice was not a good voice. So he got John Barrymore records and John Gielgud records and emulated them and became the F. Murray Abraham we know. I once asked him, where does this F come from? Well, he said, my first name is Fahid.
No, he said, no, Fahid.
Yes, people would not want to know Fahid when I was starting out in the 60s. he's a terrific fellow and someone I like very much. And we've spent time together. Mike Nichols introduced us in London. And from that time on, we've done it. In fact, we're going to be doing a new play about Norman Mailer. That Ooh. he's going to play Norman Mailer. And all of the words that he says in the play, every word is what Norman Mailer wrote or said. So it's not a one-man show, though.
Strangely enough, I was watching When We Were Kings last night, the Ali documentary about the Rumble of the Jungle, and there he is, Mailer, you know, in his pomp, giving it the full Mailer effect. So that's going to be absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, he was quite a man. He predicted a Donald Trump. He said there will be a time in America that something will come to America that's quite different than what we have. And I don't want to get into it, and it's political, and I figure I'm a showbiz guy, so let's just say he predicted the coming of a man like Donald Trump. Mm.
You're not a political guy, but you're a showbiz guy. As I said, this weekend is the Oscars. It's great to see small productions like Banshees in Inisherin and the Jamie Lee Curtis's produced movie, which I always call Everywhere, Everything, All at Once, and they look like they're going to do really, really well. And that's in a universe that is taken over by franchises, not knocking them, and sequels and Men in Very Tight Lycra shooting things. It's going to be a good sign, hasn't it?
It's true. And it's also wonderful if you're lucky enough to be able to present work that you can be proud of, that it's not about making the buck. It's something that you can say, wow, I'm pretty glad I did this. You know, I went years ago to the closing of a little play in London called Vita and Virginia. It starred Penelope Wilton and Eileen Atkins, and it had not done well, but I was totally taken in by the beauty of the English language. I'd forgotten how beautiful our language can be. And certainly that's because Virginia Woolf wrote, what she wrote. And Eileen Atkins actually adapted this play. I went to the producer and said, I want to bring it to America. I said, but I want to change. I don't want the director. And I love Penelope Wilton, but she's not right for Vita Sackville-West, the way I see it. Well, who would you like to have? I said, I'd like to have Diana Rigg. I said, she's tall and she has that face that's very similar. And he said, well, what if I could get Vanessa Redgrave? And I think to myself, I'm in a little office in what they call Beecham. I would pronounce it Beauchamp. B-E-A-C-H-A-M-P. But it's called Beecham in London. And I'm in a little office, and I figured, Vanessa Redgrave, this is a huge, huge movie star. But I didn't know that a couple of weeks later, when he called me and he said, I had got Vanessa Redgrave, that it had been his former mother-in-law. He had been married to Natasha Richardson. So he knew Vanessa Redgrave. Anyhow, that's how it happened. We took this two-character play from London where he said, I've just lost £190,000. Well, he had lost 100, but we made a lot of money in New York with it, and I was very proud to present that play. So, you know, you just don't know where it's going to come from. And the idea that I went to the closing at this little theater with this two-character play became one of the most successful plays I ever produced.
What do you hope that people take from the book? I don't want to say it's a snapshot from a golden age, but it was definitely an interesting time. And you think you're running around. Bob Evans is off doing what he was doing at the time as well. It must have been pre-social media, pre-franchises. It must have been, and you were sort of pushing the boundaries and in a good way, making it up as you went along.
Well, it's true. And I was very pleased to see in the reviews for the book in America how many people talked what you just said, that it was a different time, a time that will never come again, that I grew up in. I grew up with the radio. Now, like we have right now, as a kid, your imagination runs wild. You're on the range with the Lone Ranger. You're going down a Jack Benny's vault down these steps. I mean, you're conjuring these incredible images, and your imagination does run wild. Television takes that away. You just sit back and children don't have to imagine. But I grew up really imagining, probably too much, but I did. The irony of it was that I ended up having my own radio show for 9 years in New York. Called Julian Schlossberg's Movie Talk, was on from 8 to midnight. A lot of hours to talk.
Yeah, but it's New York, so you've got people calling in. I would imagine that make it even more entertaining.
Well, yes, and I love call. I'd call in, so people would call in and they would talk. And I was lucky enough to get Jack Nicholson, Betty Davis, John Huston. I got the biggest names in show business did the show. And that was very exciting. And the reason they did the show, I found out, was that the word got out that I read the book. I saw the movie. I went to the play. They were so used to being interviewed by people who would say, so tell me what your new movie's about, you know? And so the word got out, hey, he does his homework. Go do him. He'll know about you. And that was kind of nice. I was glad that's so I ended up, as I say, with all these unbelievable names. Bob Hope, George Burns, John Huston. I mean, you name him, I had it. And that was exciting.
Very rarely do I sit here and just go, oh my goodness. But Julian, you've absolutely, I mean, in the best possible way, have absolutely blown me away this afternoon. The book is, and I could have talked to you for, at least until Monday, but unfortunately I'm going to do this fatal thing, and you will know this having worked in radio, you do not crash the news, and it's coming up quick. This book is called Try Not to Hold It Against Me. It is by Julian Schlossberg. Julian, if people want to find you online, I know there's a website because I've seen it, and it's a very handsome picture, sir.
I loved it. And anytime you want me from Spain, New York, I'm here. Okay.
Julian, the book is called Trying to Hold It Against Me. Julian, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you so much. Have a lovely weekend.